Welcome everyone to Eruption, why K-12 schools will lose thousands of teachers and millions of students unless senior leaders act. I am Justin Bader, director of the Instructional Leadership Directors Roundtable, and our agenda for today, we're going to talk about five main things in this session, and I would love to have your input if you're joining us live, so feel free to participate by leaving a comment at any time. First, we're going to talk about probability and risk, and the idea of becoming anti-fragile to black swan events. I'm reading a great series of books by Nassim Taleb right now on black swan events and anti-fragility, and I think there's some very important lessons for us in K-12 education. We'll talk about the specific risks that we are vulnerable to in K-12 around losing staff and students who just say, you know what, I'm just going to take this year off. I'm going to not show up. I'm going to not enroll. I'm going to not work. I'm going to take a leave. You know, I feel like we face some very specific risks there. I don't want to outline those and talk about some mitigation strategies and get your input on what you are doing to mitigate those risks. We'll talk about a little bit of evidence that's starting to emerge from the school systems that have reopened around the world and what we might expect as new evidence continues to come in. We'll talk about evidence-driven decision-making and the idea of setting, kind of proactively setting trigger points where we will make the decision to go virtual if certain criteria are met or if certain targets are not met in terms of containing the virus. And we will talk about specific recommendations for retaining staff and students. And I'm going to share my perspective specifically as a parent. You know, this is basically all we can think about as parents right now, right? Is it safe to send my kids back? What do we do? This virtual learning thing, you know, I would like to also get some work done. And we have a lot of difficult choices to make as parents. And then we know different parents, depending on their personal circumstances, have a very different set of options to even choose from. And what we do as educators, of course, has to respect the needs and the wishes of parents, but of course, the needs and wishes of our staff as well. So does that sound good? Give me a yes in the chat if that sounds like a worthwhile set of topics. We're not going to talk about hand sanitizer today. We're not going to talk about desk spacing or partitions or chunks of, you know, students attending. You know, we're not going to talk about any of those logistics that I know you've been consumed with for weeks now, but we are going to talk about risk. So a couple of disclaimers here about my areas of expertise. I am not an infectious disease expert. I am not a medical doctor. I am not a public health official or public education official in your state. I am not your boss. I am not a parent in your schools, but I am a parent and I have to share my parent perspective as well as my educator perspective here. All right, Rhonda says, sounds good. Laura says, yes, good deal. All right, first, let's acknowledge again the importance of self-care here. This is a situation that has placed unprecedented stress on educators, both teachers and school leaders. We're being asked to plan for really the unknown. I think we can't really say much more about it than that. We're being asked to plan for the unknown. And I think we have got to be proactive in taking care of ourselves. So do not let anybody guilt you into prioritizing their needs over your own. Prioritize your health as well as the physical and mental health of your staff and your students. All right. So having said that, having made that disclaimer, I want to give you the takeaways first. So you know where I'm going with this. You know what argument I'm going to make, and then we can fill in the details of that argument and the recommendations as we go along. First of all, here's what I believe. I believe in, as you saw in the title and the graphic for this webinar, I believe that millions of educators, maybe not millions in the United States, but worldwide millions, probably hundreds of thousands at least in the US, and tens of millions of parents don't feel good about the return to in-person schooling. I will share some specific statistics. Actually, I think it probably is in the millions of educators. There is a lot of uncertainty, and that uncertainty is leading to fear. And I think that fear is quite rational. It is not just a panic. It is not just a personal kind of flaw in thinking. I think there is a legitimate concern about reopening schools. And what the aspect of that we're going to talk about today is the operational and financial risk that puts us in as K-12 organizations. I think there are some very specific situations that we will find ourselves in if we do not find ways to mitigate those risks and retain our staff and students. And that's especially true in private schools. Could you give me a me in the chat if you are in a tuition-based school or a school that otherwise will lose funding if your students stay home? Especially parochial schools, Jewish day schools, private schools, international schools. Give me a me if you're in one of those settings. Okay, I have at least a couple here. Because we know if kids are going to mostly stay home, their parents are going to wonder what they're paying for. And I think we've got to, especially make the case about that at this time. All right, and we will talk about the plan that I'm going to suggest to you that we can mitigate that risk with an online first, evidence-driven reopening and possibly reclosing plan. All right, so let's talk first about the nature of the risks and the events that we're facing. Nassim Taleb is a retired options trader. You might think of him as an economist, although he's not really an economist. And he's written a series, four or five books, that he's calling the Incerto around uncertainty. And probably the best known of those is The Black Swan, not the Natalie Portman movie about ballet dancers, but the Black Swan in the sense of a rare, unforeseeable, unpredictable event. And he said, Taleb says that Black Swan events have three characteristics. They are rare. We do not know how often they will occur, but they do not occur very often. When they do occur, they have an extreme impact. They have an enormous impact. And that impact is not really measurable or predictable or quantifiable in advance. And that's where he draws on his experience as a trader. You know, there's a tendency to say, well, there's a 1% chance of this happening. Well, but we really don't know if something that hardly ever happens is truly a 1% chance, right? A classic example is flooding, right? Everybody knows how what kind of floodplain they live in. You know, if flooding is a thing that occurs in your area, you know, oh, I live in a 50-year floodplain or a 100-year floodplain or a 500-year floodplain. And what that means is that the insurance company estimates that that area will flood every, say, 500 years. Well, of course, we don't actually know whether that area will flood in any given 500-year period. Those events, those black swan events, are so rare that they're only quote unquote predictable in retrospect, which is, of course, to say that they are not predictable at all. And, you know, if you've watched any of the movies about the 2008 financial crisis, you know that there were people who saw it coming, who predicted some of the vulnerabilities in the markets and maybe even made big bets. I think The Big Short was one of my favorite movies. Anybody seen The Big Short? I think you can find it on streaming services, about people who saw the problems in subprime mortgages and other financial institutions and said, you know what, I'm going to put all my money in this. I think something big is about to happen here. Taleb has spent his career dealing with those kinds of events and looking at the ways that different people talk about predicting them and realizing that a lot of those predictions are not really predictions. We could not have predicted the 9/11 attacks. We could not have predicted Hurricane Katrina. But what we could have done in each of those situations is look at our vulnerability to a black swan event. Right, it was a big surprise that Hurricane Katrina flooded New Orleans, but it was not a surprise to anyone that New Orleans is below sea level, right? That is a known fact, and we can know our vulnerabilities to black swan events to a much greater extent than we can predict those events themselves. So right now, if you are finding yourself extraordinarily stressed by the unpredictability of what is going to happen in the coming months, you are not alone, of course, and there is not really a solution to that that will give you the certainty, that will give you the predictability that you need. I believe our best course of action as senior leaders is to instead identify our vulnerabilities to those events and address the vulnerability, knowing that we cannot predict or control the events themselves. Does that make sense? That distinction between predictability and vulnerability. Does that make sense? That you know, we don't know the likelihood of any given scenario unfolding, but we can assess and mitigate our vulnerability to that black swan type of event. Does that make sense? Let me know in the chat. We'll talk a little bit further about that before we move on from Taleb's work. The book I'm reading right now is Anti-Fragile, and he says that there are three types of systems or three types of things in the world. There are fragile things like a vase or a coffee cup that break easily, and other things are more robust. You know, if you have a ceramic coffee cup, that can break easily. If you have a metal coffee cup, that might be more resilient or robust. But there's a third type of object or of system that he calls anti-fragile. And he says anti-fragile things actually improve as chaos increases. And one of the most obvious examples of something anti-fragile is genes, right? Nature, you know, through natural selection, produces stronger and stronger individuals and stronger genes through the process of natural selection, but at the cost of the individual. So there are lots of examples in the book. It's kind of an abstract concept. But what we're going to focus on just briefly here for our purposes is what creates fragility? What makes organizations vulnerable to black swan events, which is, you know, I think a pretty good fit for what we're dealing with right now. Three of the drivers that Taleb identifies as creating vulnerability are size. He says, you know, when we have too big to fail financial institutions, that creates a big vulnerability. It makes our economy fragile when we have a bank that is so big that if the bank fails, basically the economy goes under, and that's why we've had these massive bailouts. So certainly size, scale is a driver of fragility and vulnerability. Complexity is another one, and we saw some of the complexity vulnerabilities come up in the 2008 financial crisis when it came to the obscure financial instruments like collateralized debt obligations and other things that, you know, were not household terms prior to that crisis. Well, you know, the more complex and abstract and confusing something is, the more likely it is to be highly fragile. And of course, we're seeing that with the supply chain as well. When something is complex, when it's difficult to make things and get them to people, we experience fragility and vulnerability to black swan events. And finally, he says efficiency. When we have squeezed all of the wiggle room out of something, it becomes more fragile. And I cannot think of a better paragon of efficiency than our schools, right? We are skeleton crew, right? We are bare bones. We have only the number of people that we absolutely need. We do not have, you know, empty classrooms. We do not have extra teachers sitting around. We do not have extra time on our hands. We do not have extra money. Schools typically operate very efficiently, as do hospitals, right? Hospital ICUs are almost always at near capacity on a normal basis. And that's why we're seeing a high degree of vulnerability and concern about ICU capacity right now as more and more people have to get hospitalized due to COVID-19. So these drivers of fragility are what's behind some of the big news that you have been seeing lately. You might have seen recently that two large California districts, Los Angeles County and San Diego, both elected to open online only. They're doing virtual instruction for the beginning of the school year. And I think that's because they are large, and because they are large, they are efficient and they are fragile. Now, if you work for a large district, as I did, you might think, well, I don't feel like my district is very efficient. But what we mean by efficiency is just that there's not a lot of wiggle room. It doesn't mean there's no waste. It means that we operate kind of near capacity, right? We're trying to take advantage of economies of scale. And that means when any of our inputs or outputs change dramatically, we are vulnerable. We are fragile in the face of those changes. And we have very few choices as far as how to react other than to kind of, you know, make the dramatic moves that we saw Los Angeles and San Diego do recently to open online only. And I think we will see more of those in the coming weeks. Let me know what you think about that in terms of scale and fragility and efficiency. And we'll move on from Taleb's work and start talking about what we can do. But basically, because black swan events like viruses, you know, pandemics, financial crashes, you know, extreme weather events like Katrina, terrorist attacks, things like that, because they cannot be predicted or prevented, our best recourse is to reduce our exposure to them. So for senior leaders who are joining us today, that is our goal. That is our focus throughout the rest of our time together. And the two main types of exposure that I think we need to be concerned about are the loss of staff simply through retirement or resignation, through calling in sick, through taking a medical leave, through failing to return from a medical leave that they were planning to return from, through all the different ways that we can lose staff and just effectively not end up with a person to teach the class when we need someone there. And second, the loss of students. And there are a couple of categories of loss of students. One is to, you know, homeschooling, to for-profit virtual instruction that's available in most states. You know, if you, let me know, do you know for a fact that you lose students to for-profit virtual schools, or at least virtual schools that take money out of your organization if you're in a public school district? Do you have an, is there an option for parents in your state to enroll their children in a virtual school that is not yours? Like, you lose the money if they go for that. Rivka says yes. Lindsay says yes. I know, I think we can do K-12 in our state, K-12.com. Aaron says yes. Peggy says yes. I'm pretty sure that's available almost everywhere. You know, they're a very politically powerful organization, and they're primed to benefit from the disorder that is going on right now. So I would say, like, K-12.com is an anti-fragile kind of organization in this situation. They're really poised to benefit from this at your expense, at our expense, in public and private, traditional schools. So our goal here is to reduce our exposure to those risks simply because we cannot predict or totally prevent those risks. So here are the specific risks that I think we face right now and that we need to be prepared for and that we need to be communicating about with our staff and families. We're going to talk about teacher retirements and resignations, sick outs, and that's an unfamiliar concept to a lot of people, but I think one that will rapidly enter the parlance again after a long period of dormancy. We'll talk about quarantines, sub shortages, enrollment declines, and perhaps if you're in California, you use average daily attendance, the potential loss of funding or tuition that comes from that, and then of course underlying all of that is the risk of loss of life or health in terms of physical well-being. So let's talk first about teachers. Are you getting a sense? Let me know in the comments. Are you getting a sense that teachers are scared? Let me know in the chat. I am paying attention to, I'm in two primary teacher groups that I just kind of lurk in and kind of get a sense of what the zeitgeist is among teachers. I saw a huge outcry about people putting together wills, estate planning workshops. I think Houston ISD was initially offering an estate planning workshop, and people started to say, wait a minute, if you are offering an estate planning workshop, why are we even talking about reopening? Heather says many are terrified. Janita says definitely. Mindy says lots of fear. Laura says some are scared. Yeah, I am definitely getting a sense that the anxiety level, is, as Peggy says, through the roof. Lila says fearful, and rightly so. Yeah, teachers are not dumb, right? They are smart people. They know what they do every day in the classroom. They know how close they are to students. They know what they're going to be asked to do. And they know that we have a history in education of taking whatever impossible circumstance we're in and throwing that in teachers' laps and saying, you're amazing, you've got this, I'm sure you will figure it out. And as a society, I think we're doing that to an unprecedented degree right now. We're saying, we as a society haven't really figured out how to contain the novel coronavirus. Infection rates are spiking in a lot of different places. ICUs are filling up, but I'm sure teachers will figure it out. And I'm sure administrators will come up with a plan. And I know your role has largely been to develop the plans for the impossible, for the unworkable. So, it is no surprise that graphics like this are going around. I've seen probably five different versions of this one. If this part of the graph meant that we need to close schools, early March, April, we saw some spikes, then it's tough to see how this part of the graph, way over here on the right, means we must reopen schools. The numerical reality, this one is from Tennessee, from one particular region in Tennessee, but you could make the same graph for the whole country or for a lot of different places. This argument, I think, is a pretty compelling one, that it is tough to see how there is a data-driven case for reopening schools in a lot of places. And I know in certain regions of Canada, the numbers are very different But I get the sense that because the vigilance is higher, you know, the feelings are largely the same. So yeah, let me know if you're in a particular region that, you know, where the virus is or is not contained. I'd love to know what you're hearing and what the sense from teachers is. You know, and this particular person was concerned. This is a teacher, I think, in a private school. Yeah. This particular teacher was concerned that masks were not being required, that the teacher was going to have to be within 6 feet of students in order to do her job, and really was not getting the sense that the policies were going to be in place to protect her. And I think we have a lot of staff members who have immunocompromised family members who they live with, that they cannot isolate from, maybe who are personally immunocompromised or who have multiple pre-existing conditions. That really make this probably our primary vulnerability as organizations. And I want to challenge an assumption that I think a lot of senior leaders are making right now. The idea that, well, everybody just has to come back. You know, they're not going to quit. They have no choice. They need the money. They need the job. Maybe they need the insurance that comes from their job. So they're not going to quit. Well, I checked. I looked up some data. There was a survey a while back, actually, back in June, when, frankly, things were not nearly as bad as they are now in the U.S., that said that before the coronavirus pandemic, 82% of teachers were definitely planning to stay in their role, and that has declined to 61%. And now, you see those little bars at the bottom there, the 18, the 11, the 9? What is the likelihood that you will leave the classroom and in retrospect, we would say, you know, what is the likelihood that you will not return for the new school year? 18 plus 11 plus 9. Those all look like kind of small numbers, but boy, they add up, don't they? We are talking about a substantial percentage of our staff that is seriously considered not coming back. And we think that everybody has to come back. We think they need the money, but the reality is that people will make choices. People will find a way if they do not feel safe coming back. And we don't normally have to deal with that calculus. We don't normally have to deal with threats to life and health in terms of, you know, often we'll have conversations with teachers. Oh, you don't really need to retire. You know, let's, you know, give it one more year. We really want to keep you around one more year. We can persuade people under normal circumstances to stay longer. And often, you know, when people love their job, it's often not a very difficult conversation. What we are facing right now, though, is completely unprecedented in our lifetimes. And I think we have to really acknowledge that reality, that perhaps 40% of our teachers are seriously considering staying home this year. In a typical year, that number is more like 14%. In a typical year, we have to replace, depending on the, you know, the area and the sector and the poverty level in the school, typically we have to replace about 14% of our teachers in a given year. Right now, we are at the end of a decade-long decline in the teacher pipeline. Since 2008-2009, we have seen the pipeline of incoming teachers who are preparing to teach, who are entering profession, shrink by about a quarter. And you and I know why that is happening. We know the societal disrespect for teachers has really pushed a lot of people to say, you know what, I'm going to do something else with my talents. So we know we were already facing a substantial teacher shortage. And right now, the double risk here, you know, we're facing this risk at both ends of the profession. When it comes to teachers who have the option to retire, I think we're going to see a huge number. And let me know in the chat, have you heard from any teacher, any specific teachers in your school who just said, you know what, I'm going to retire. You know, I wasn't sure if I was going to, maybe I won't get my full amount, or maybe I'd like to have more money set aside, but I'm just going to retire. Do you know any teachers who've actually retired? Lindsay says yes, Aaron says yes. So I think most schools are in this position where we have some of our very best teachers are either eligible for retirement or in a financial position where they may not need to work or they can do something else. And I want to acknowledge that what other industries are doing that K-12 really is not taking seriously, that we're really not taking seriously as an option, is providing remote work as an option to retain highly qualified staff, because we know we will probably not be able to replace them, at least in the short term. Oh, wow, a lot more people have said yes. Shanita says yes, Amanda says yes, 2 out of 12, Diane says, losing classified staff. Yeah, if I think about our local school, an enormous number of the classified staff are elderly. You know, the bus drivers are elderly. The cafeteria workers are elderly. The playground supervisors are elderly. And they may or may not need the money. They may or may not have other options, but they may make the choice to stay home this year. And of course, in some of those roles, there is no such thing as remote work, right? You cannot telecommute and be a bus driver. But we are going to have to think about what we can do to hold on to our concerned and fearful, at least teaching staff. Here is what is more likely going to happen for more people, though. You know, I'm sure you've been thinking about retention. I'm sure you've been thinking about resignations and retirements. But a big one that is probably not on the radar of most senior leaders is the possibility of a sick out. And a sick out can mean a couple of different things. We'll use this term to mean to cover a couple of different things. The traditional labor action of a sick out operates, you know, this is employed when teachers are prohibited from striking, as they are in a lot of states. You know, when maybe there's a union, but there is a law preventing that union from calling a general strike to negotiate, you know, bring the district to the bargaining table. When it is not possible to strike, one option that has not been used in a very long time in most places is for everyone to simply call in sick and say, you know what, I've come down with a terrible fever. I'm sorry, I will not be in today. Typically, those are short-term actions. Has anyone ever experienced a sick out in their career? Have you ever witnessed one? Maybe you weren't even in the profession at that time, but have you ever heard of a sick out or experienced one in your area? It's been a long time. Diane says yes. Diane, let us know where you are if you don't mind. Been on strike as a teacher, people say. Several no's. Wisconsin, yeah. Oh, yeah. The Wisconsin situation, absolutely. So sick outs are, a time-tested oldie, but, a reliable strategy for people who really are working under intolerable conditions. And the way that can happen right now, there are a whole lot of different options that could occur. People can, of course, simply call in sick in the short term. Longer term, they could take leave. They could fail to return from leave. They could say, you know what, I had a baby in June and I'm not coming back. I thought I would, but I'm just going to give up my position even though I have a contract. That's an option. People can take FMLA leave or whatever it's called in your country. Family and Medical Leave Act provides, you know, some provisions for people to have their job held for them for a certain period of time. And there are federally protected conditions that allow people to do that. I'm not an expert on that, and I'm not going to give you advice on that other than to say that this is probably going to happen. The third sick out possibility that could occur is people saying, I need to quarantine. And of course, we will have many legitimate and real self-quarantine situations where people say, you know what, I went to a family reunion, I was exposed, and the people who did my COVID test said I need to self-quarantine for 14 days. Well, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to realize that a significant number of teachers having to quarantine for 14 days is going to put us in a very difficult position when it comes to staffing our classrooms, right? This is a very real risk. It only takes a few people to be out to really make brick and mortar, in-person schooling unviable. We simply will not be able to staff our classrooms if this happens. And I think we need to start communicating with the public about this fairly early and with our staff as well. But there is a real risk that if staff members are sick, if they are taking leave, or if they are put into 14-day quarantines, that in-person schooling will be unviable. My suggestion to you, this is kind of my first write it down takeaway, is that all of that uncertainty and all of that risk be described to the public as a risk of teacher quarantine. Because honestly, we will not know. You know, if a teacher calls in sick and says, you know what, I've been advised to self-quarantine for 14 days, we're not going to ask prying questions. We're not going to say, oh, is it because you're scared? We're not going to do that. We're not going to say, oh, is it because you have diabetes? No, we are going to say that people are quarantining. And I think when it comes to kind of explaining to parents, explaining to the public, this should probably be our primary language, that we have teachers who are quarantining. And that is going to be basically, you know, the most understandable, the most, we're going to get the most empathy from parents for our teachers. We're going to get the least anger from parents if we describe this as simply people are quarantining. Especially if we know that it's not necessarily long term. Obviously, if someone has retired, you can say that they retired, and that is what it is. We don't need to try to paint it as anything else. But I think generally the messaging about the necessity of teacher quarantining is going to become very urgent. We need to get on this right away. Let's see. Diane says, I have 12 teachers who cover 15 schools for intervention. Half of them are 55 and over. Absolutely. And Becky says, we have to consider EFMLA because of COVID reasons. And Becky, if you want to say more about that, I'd love to hear more what you mean by that specifically. Again, that's not my area of expertise, but I think the reality is we are going to have people who say, you know what, I'm not coming in for 2 weeks, or I'm not coming in this year and I'm taking leave and you have to hold my contract for me. We just have to be prepared for that. And I believe we have to communicate that. And Sharika is asking a very good question here. How do we handle this anger from parents if teachers are out because they are quarantining? I think that's where we have to say, you know what, this is the policy. You know, this is public health policy. If someone has been advised to quarantine, they're putting us all at risk if they do not. So we have to respect that. And of course, the reality is, I don't think you get a doctor's note if you're supposed to quarantine. I don't know. I probably would not be asking for those. I don't know what exactly the provisions are in your area, but I think we're going to hear that a lot, and we need to let parents know that we are going to hear that. This has already come up in the chat several times here. Subs are elderly as well. The next risk that we've got to be prepared for is sub shortages. They are going to be in shorter supply than ever before. Many are simply going to say, you know what, I got other stuff going on. I'm going to stay home with my kids, or I'm going to do my other, side gig that I do. I'm going to sell stuff on Etsy. I'm going to stay retired. You know, probably some of our most reliable subs are our recently retired teachers, who of course are the oldest, who are, maybe the most likely to have health conditions. And even among the subs who are ready and willing to work, we are probably going to very rapidly have quarantining issues from subs who are in different classrooms. You know, if you're in one classroom all day, or if you're in seven different classrooms all day, or one classroom with seven groups of students, you know, there is a huge risk of exposure here when we do any kind of contact tracing and figure out, okay, who was exposed to this person who is confirmed to have COVID-19. Well, our subs are going to be at the top of that list. Even though you may not have a ton of subs, they are going to be at a very high risk of being on that list of people who need to be quarantined. And of course, we may have some restrictions on how exactly we can employ subs to move between classes. You know, if the rule is, if you come into work, you have to be with one group of students all day, you know, I don't know how that's going to be handled in your organization, but suffice it to say, subs are going to be a big vulnerability. And you know, we rely on subs more often than we like. You know, we tend to get good subs and hang on to them and not really worry about it, but this is a big vulnerability. Yeah. And of course, in addition to full staffing and hiring. One additional hiring vulnerability that I meant to mention that I don't think I did is, you know, if we have recent college graduates, they may be eager to take these jobs because they're younger, they're healthier, they're at lower risk. But at the same time, young people often have the luxury of not working. You know, if you don't have a mortgage, if you don't have a family, you can live with your parents. You know, many of our teachers who are just now entering the profession also have the option of simply not taking a job. They can live with their parents for another year, or continue to work at Starbucks or whatever it is that they're doing. And we've got to be mindful of that option that they have. All right, so what can we do to mitigate these staffing risks? I say all of this not to further discourage you or give you one more thing to worry about, but to say that I think we do need to be proactive about this. We do need to talk with our staff about what this is going to look like, about their feelings. We need to be empathetic. We need to be patient. We need to the greatest extent possible, offer flexibility. And if we don't offer flexibility, what I want all senior leaders everywhere to realize is that in this kind of situation, teachers have administrators over a barrel. They have an enormous amount of power to simply not show up. And since it's their life, that's in question, they should, right? There's nothing wrong with people having the legal ability to say, you know what, I'm going to take leave. You cannot fire me. I'm going to take FMLA leave, and you have to give me my job back when I come back. But, you know, I got to deal with my diabetes, or I got to deal with my whatever. And, you know, there are some HR issues there that I'm not an expert in. But I believe that if we do not offer that flexibility and that empathy to our staff, then we will live to regret it. We will have lots of rude awakenings when it comes to what actually teachers are able to, you know, to do in terms of protecting themselves. So my general advice is to offer that flexibility. There really is a lot of control that teachers have over whether they show up, whether they say, I don't think we'll have the kinds of things that we've seen young people do where they intentionally expose themselves to COVID-19. I don't think teachers will do that. I think the health concerns are legitimate, but we know that the quarantining is something that is going to be a big possibility here. So my recommendation to you is that a big part of your reopening planning not just be about how do we space out the desks and how do we get the kids to wash their hands and how do we do lunch, but under what circumstances do we close the campus and go to virtual learning if we have a staff shortage? Because I hate to say it, I hate to, you know, to add one more thing to your plate, but we are going to have staff shortages at least temporarily within the profession. And I hope it doesn't happen in your school, but I would be lying to you if I said I think it was not going to happen. I think it is going to happen. We are going to struggle with subs. We are going to struggle with retaining teachers who are eligible for retirement. We are going to struggle with hiring. And of course, all of those problems get more severe in higher needs schools. So we have got to have a plan to close and to explain that closure to parents if we are unable to staff. Does anybody disagree with me on this? Let me know what you think. Can we run schools if we don't have enough teachers? Do we have an alternative? I would love to have your thinking about this. What is our alternative if we are unable to staff our classrooms? Will we have to close? I mean, I think we do, and I would love to know your opinion on this, but I really think this is something that we have not communicated with families about, the possibility that we are simply going to be able to unable to staff our classrooms. Let me know what you think in the chat. And if we get, Corey says, if we get to that point, will the schools already be forced closed? I don't know. I think it's going to vary based on the kind of climate in your state. Let's see. Administrators do not. And this is a really good point here. I want to acknowledge this, Lindsay. Administrators do not have the authority to make a call to close the school. And for that reason, many administrators are not worried about this. Many administrators are saying, well, that's a public health decision. That's a superintendent decision or a state governor decision. So I don't have to worry about that. Actually, you do have to figure out what your recourse is going to be if you cannot staff your school. Because I promise, there are going to be hundreds of schools this year. There might be thousands of schools that are unable to fully staff, unable to supervise students. And remember, you can't just double up. You can't just pack two classrooms worth of students into one classroom if you have a teacher that doesn't show. I know we do that sometimes, especially in elementary or PE. You know, if you have a PE teacher who's out sick, sometimes the other PE teacher, you know, takes all the classes for the day. We know those things are going to be off the table. So I want to encourage you to develop and communicate a plan for closing your school if you are unable to staff. This is going to happen. I promise. I hope it doesn't happen in your school, but I think there is a reasonable chance of that. And since we can't predict the chance, since we can't control it, what we can do is prepare to mitigate it. And of course, our recourse there really is closure and moving to virtual learning. Yeah, there is a lot to think about here. And again, I'm sorry to put one more thing on your plate. But we've got to be proactive with communicating with our senior leadership. You know, if you're not the superintendent, you know, this is a conversation to have with your superintendent. What do we do when we get to that point when seven of our teachers have to self-quarantine for 14 days and we have zero subs? We may have to go to virtual instruction, even if the public health guidance does not require us to do that. Diane says, all of our teachers are getting Google certified for just that reason. So Diane, that's exactly the kind of thing that I think we should be doing to make ourselves resilient and even anti-fragile in the face of these challenges. I think we've got to look at the skills that we're developing, the capabilities. You know, I think the early moves to get devices into kids' hands have been good and have moved us in the right direction. What I want to talk about next is specifically for schools that are dependent on tuition or families opting into your school, about enrollment decline. I think we've got to really face this issue head on, again, knowing that it's highly uncertain. But I want to share some of the parent perspective that I am hearing and that I am personally kind of feeling as a parent. And again, we've heard a lot of our attendees today are in schools where you are tuition dependent, or parents have a choice of whether to enroll their children in another option that removes funding from you. This is an article from the Strong Attitude blog, Scary Mommy. I see these articles being shared among parents all the time. This one is called 15 Reasons I'm Keeping My Kids Home Next Year. And I will certainly say that this is a privileged perspective. This is from a parent who can keep her daughter home or her kids home this year without, catastrophic kind of personal consequences. There are parents who have that choice and parents who really don't. There are lots of parents who will have to send their kids to school if school is open. And the reason I'm saying that we need to hear from the parents who have the choice is because it is highly likely that they will exercise that flexibility, that privilege, that choice that they have in ways that create vulnerabilities for schools. So some of the big points in this article, honestly, there are a lot of the same things that educators are worried about. We don't know a lot about the safety of opening schools. We don't know a lot about the long-term health impacts on children. But what we do know as educators is we do know that parents, just like teachers, are worried. This was a survey from July 14th, an Ipsos survey that said that 71% of parents see a moderate or large risk to sending their child back to school in person. 71%. And we know that 71% of parents don't really have a choice. We know that the percentage of parents overall in society that have a choice, that it could keep their kids home if they wanted to, is much lower than that. But if you are a tuition-dependent school, if parents pay to send their children to you, then probably 71% of them do have a choice. They can maybe hire a tutor, they can hire a nanny, they can hire an au pair, they can keep their kids home. Maybe they are not a dual-income household. The situation is going to depend a great deal on your population. But in terms of attitude, we know 71% of parents think there is a moderate or large risk. And the second question here, how concerned are you with sending your child to school in the fall? 51% are very or extremely concerned. And that's an Ipsos poll from July 14th. So this is reflecting some of the reopenings that have occurred toward the end of the 1920 school year. We'll talk a little bit about some emerging data from Israel in just a moment. So what is it that parents are looking for? And in fact, if you are a parent, or if you have been maybe you don't have young kids right now, but as a parent, if you have that parent perspective, what are you looking for in terms of that decision to send your kid back to school? What are your priorities? These are U.S. parents, I believe, Rivka. I believe these are U.S. parents, and I think this is a pretty general U.S. poll. So I don't know that it was targeted at a certain population or area. I think it's just U.S. parents in general. But feel free to check that out at the link that's provided there. But what are you feeling? What is your personal feeling as a parent? And I know as educators, really we have to wear both hats. We have to think, okay, I'm concerned about my kid, but of course I have to be at, if school is open, I have to be at school all day. And so I don't really have a choice unless there are grandparents or spouse or somebody who is able to cover there. Let me know what you think personally as a parent in the comments here. How do you feel about personally sending your own kids back to school? Let me know. Let's see. Concerned that the school doesn't have a solid plan. Wanting to see the school working to mitigate as much as possible, knowing that they can't eliminate all risk. I need to know that my son is as safe as he can be. He's my life. Process and procedure, if X, then Y, to assure I know what to expect when I send my kid to school. Yeah, that if X, then Y planning, I think, is one of the best forms of communication that we can do. If this happens, here is how we are going to React. And hopefully your existing plans have a lot of that. And my goal today was to draw your attention to the staffing risk in particular. And then we're going to talk about the student enrollment risk now as well. Not sending them back. I worry about my high schooler's mental health. If we stay online, yeah, absolutely. This is hard on kids. You know, there are no easy choices here because staying home, of course, has its costs. Absolutely. So I made a list here of a couple things that I want as a parent that I think most people would put toward the top of their list. Safety obviously comes first, but we also need predictability. I don't know if what options were presented to your parents, but we got options that were basically, do you want to be online or in person? And of course, our question was, well, what does that look like? What do you mean by online? And what measures will you put in place in person? You know, if we go back, how many kids are going to be in the class? Are masks going to be required? Are kids going to wash their hands? You know, what's lunch going to look like? There were a lot of questions that were just unanswered at the time that we had to make a decision. So predictability is huge. Obviously, we don't want to make a plan and then see that plan get disrupted. I saw a post from, I think, We Are Teachers that said, describe the new school year in 4 words. And an incredible number, it had over 1,000 comments. And the number one response that I saw as I scrolled through those comments was closed again by October. I saw a lot of different variations on that, where probably parents as well, but teachers certainly think that continuity is going to be disrupted. Parents and teachers expect that whatever plans we have are going to go out the window, and that scares us. That worries us because we want that continuity. And fourth, of course, we want quality instruction. We know that a lot of what was delivered in the spring as online or virtual instruction was of very low quality. And if you are in a tuition-dependent school, if parents are paying for their kids to be there, of course, that quality has to be there, or they are going to find it not worth it to have their kids at home needing to be supervised by them or somebody in their family simply for the sake of that instruction they're receiving. It has to be good instruction. But in making this list and ranking safety first, I am being a little bit deceptive. And the way I'm being deceptive, the way I'm misleading you with this list, is by making all of these the same font size. And if you're looking away from the screen, you might want to look at the screen here. I think it is much more like this. For parents who have a choice, as well as the parents who do not have a choice but do have strong feelings, safety is 90% of this. It is not proportional to the others. It is not just safety first. It is safety 100 times more than any other concern. It is not even in the ballpark. Do I think that my kids will get a better learning experience in person? Yes. Do I care when safety is my first concern? No, not even close. Not even close. And I'm speaking for myself as a parent. My kids are going into second and fourth grade. And I have to tell you, you know, I am not concerned about what they will lose out on educationally because of the privilege that we have as educators, as highly educated people who can buy books and take our kids to the library. And, you know, I'm not worried about my own kids falling behind. And I think there's a huge amount of privilege that goes into that. But even if no learning, you know, even if my kids had to play Nintendo for an entire year, I would choose safety, no question. Absolutely no question. And of course, people have different feelings about that. I'm absolutely responding to this or expressing that opinion from a place of privilege. But Mindy says, education is the least of my concern, way more about safety and mental health. Yeah, and of course, we can't ignore mental health. That's rolled into the equation in a fairly complicated way. You know, but I'll be completely honest with you. I'm fine for my kids to learn nothing for a year if it keeps them alive. And that's just my honest opinion as a parent here. So when it comes to acceptable risk, I think there is basically, in my view, I'm going to skip ahead here and then come back to that. I think there's basically no acceptable risk when it comes to physical safety. You know, there is no quality of learning that justifies any measurable risk to human life, right? if I'm going to say this in a couple of different ways, because I think I've heard different reasoning about this that I don't agree with, and then I think people have not thought through all the way. People say, well, everything is risky. You know, there's no way to go through life with zero risks. And of course, that's true. Any of us could die in a car accident any given day. You know, there are medical conditions that could affect any of us at any given time. And, you know, we don't really have control over that as human beings. Life is what it is. But here's the situation we are in K-12 schools. We do not ever, ever damage or risk people's physical safety or health above their baseline risk of, you know, existing in the world for the sake of learning. And I want to say this a couple of different ways. If you were planning a field trip and you said, you know what, we're going to take the entire field trip, the entire school on this field trip to the fair or the pumpkin patch or whatever, you know, your traditional field trips are. If you said, if a teacher came to you and said, you know what, this is a very safe field trip. Typically, we only lose one or two students and one or two teachers a year on this field trip. They fall off the cliff or they get bitten by an animal and die. If a teacher came to you and said, those are our typical numbers, you know, 99% of people are going to come back safely. It's going to be fine. And it's going to be a very valuable learning experience. You would look at that person as if they were insane. If there were any non-zero probability of someone dying, we would say, shut it down. We are not under any circumstances going to take a field trip that has any possibility of resulting in death. Now, of course, vehicle accidents happen whether we go to school or not. So I'm kind of leaving out, you know, bus accidents and things like that because, you know, those are part of the baseline risk of existing. And I think those don't really count as educational risks. But historically, we lose zero students per year to learning-related causes. Have you ever had an assembly that was so dangerous that someone died? I am going to guess that you have not. Have you ever had a learning experience that resulted in death? No. The answer is no. And if you don't understand why people are fearful, it's because of this. It's because we don't typically put people at mortal risk in school. And this year is different. And I'm sorry if I'm getting too passionate about this, but I feel like we have a very difficult time understanding these black swan risks as humans. We'll talk about that in just a second here. But you know, we have squeezed all of the physical risk out of K-12 schooling. You know, sports deaths, I think, probably are the main ways that people die in school-sponsored activities, but even those are increasingly rare, thankfully. There is no acceptable risk to human life for the sake of learning. And I know there are no easy decisions here because there are risks and costs to keeping schools closed, certainly, so I don't mean to minimize that. But what I do mean to say is that people's ability to reason and make decisions about very small probabilities is constrained by the size of those probabilities. We really struggle to estimate risks that are lower than 1%. But if you think about the 500-year flood, if you think about the terrorist attack, if you think about the plane crash, by the way, this is interesting. I saw, you know how many people died in commercial plane crashes in the US last year in 2019? Anybody have an idea of how many fatalities occurred from commercial plane crashes in 2019? Give me a number in the chat if you've got a guess, and I'd love to see your guesses. We have come to expect a very high degree of safety in our society, and that was not the case 100 years ago. Steven Pinker has an excellent book called Enlightenment Now, as well as another book that preceded that. The title's escaping me right now, but basically he argues that we've gotten better at safety. We've gotten better at reducing risks to human life, and it is extraordinarily rare that we actually put people in physical danger now. Alexander is correct. Rivka is correct. There were zero commercial plane crash deaths in the United States last year. And that's pretty remarkable. You know, we still hear about plane crashes now and then, but often those are, you know, transcontinental flights from airlines that are based in other countries. In the US, we had zero commercial airline deaths in 2019. And this is our expectation now as a society. And it is how we make our personal decisions that if there is a non-zero chance of death, we're out. We're not going to do it. But I am hearing things all the time on social media. Well, you know, 99% of people who get coronavirus survive and they're fine. So why are we shutting down the country? Why are we shutting down schools for a 1% fatality rate? And the misconception there is that 1% is low. as humans, we intuitively are capable of thinking in percentage terms, but we need to not think in percentage terms when it comes to safety in schools. And I think this is why it's our largest districts that are the most vulnerable, that are the most fragile, that are going to have the most staffing issues, that have shut down first and said, you know what, we're going to open virtually for the time being, because they are thinking in per 10,000 or per 100,000 terms, not percent terms, right? How many deaths do we typically have in an elementary school in a decade? You know, probably one or zero, depending. And Rivka says, the expectation of having complete control over safety is unrealistic. Yeah, absolutely. I think there are things that are out of our control, but here is the thing that I want everybody to understand. Opening school is in people's control. It may not be in our control as administrators, and I think that's one of the most frustrating things about this and why I wanted to have an honest conversation about this. You may have no choice but to open school in person. But the two groups of people who do have a choice are teachers, who may choose not to show up in various ways, and parents, who may choose not to send their students. And the way we mitigate those risks is to be very clear about the conditions under which we will go to virtual instruction, and to do everything we can to make sure that virtual instruction is an appealing option to people. I agree. There is no way to get these risks down to zero. But at the same time, we are not able to absorb a non-zero risk of fatality in schools. And I think the best article that I can point you to on that is probably this Scary Mommy article. You can Google it. 15 Reasons I'm Keeping My Kids Home Next Year on Scary Mommy. The perception of risk to parents is just different. You know, if we're thinking in percent terms, we really need to be thinking in terms of per 10,000, not per one. I saw another post on social media that really said, you know what, everybody's going to feel like that 1% is fine until a death occurs in their community. And then it's going to be, there's going to be a lot of blame going around. I wanted to put these numbers in context a little bit. I was curious about the risk of other professions. And I know a lot of healthcare providers have died during the COVID-19 pandemic, and certainly those deaths are tragic. I think they are heroic, but we should not ask people to be heroes when they show up to work. I think we should have the protections in place, the equipment in place, the procedures in place to make sure that that does not happen. But I had to ask myself, okay, what's the most dangerous job in the world? And precisely how dangerous is that job? And my wife and I were watching Jack Ryan last night on Amazon Prime. Jim from The Office gets to be a CIA agent, you know, kind of a fun show. I enjoy it. It's a little stressful to watch sometimes. But it occurred to me that the most dangerous job on the planet, I didn't compare different jobs, but one of the most dangerous jobs on the planet has got to be being a Navy SEAL, right? What percentage of Navy SEALs die in combat? Well, I looked it up, and you know what it is? It's 1%. It's about 1 in 115 or 1 in 120 U.S. Navy SEALs die in combat. And that made me stop and think that all this rhetoric that we're seeing that, oh, 99% of people will be fine, we have got to stop talking that way. We have got to stop thinking that way. Because after the deaths occur, we are not going to have the luxury of thinking of it that way. We are not going to think that 1% mortality is good. So what I want to do now is share a little bit of early evidence. And I think there's going to be more of this day by day, and I think we're going to have to pay very close attention to this. Some schools have reopened around the world in places where the pandemic has been contained. Israel was a notable example. Give me a yes in the chat if you've followed the Israel reopening a lot. I know we have a lot of Jewish day schools represented. And let's see here. You know, give me a yes if you've been following the Israel reopens here. Let's see. My childhood community in Brooklyn was decimated. That fear is not the way I want my family to live their lives. To be careful, but not to cower. Yeah, very well said. I appreciate that. So yeah, let's keep an eye on the school systems that are reopening. I know a lot of places finished out the year because they were going to run through June anyway, and they got their outbreaks contained. And I think there's some important data that has emerged. The most important thing I think we need to realize about this data is that it's very limited so far. We simply have had schools closed, so we don't know what it's going to be like for American schools in particular to reopen. You know, every society is different. The norms in every place are different. There are places where schools have reopened safely in Southeast Asia, where a lot of the procedures around masking and sanitizing and distancing and things have been in place since 2003, since the SARS outbreak. I think we're seeing some good results there with reopening. Israel, if you are not familiar with the situation, completely eliminated, or for all intents and purposes, completely eliminated the coronavirus in, I believe, May. Yeah, it was in May, and reopened schools May 17th. And there was a high degree of confidence that because there was no community spread, I think they were down to like 10 new cases a day. There was a high degree of confidence because community spread had been contained that reopening schools would be safe. What has happened since then is that there has been an outbreak. Now, it's not huge by American standards. I see this article says 1,400 positive diagnoses, but half of them came from schools. Now, I would think a lot of American states would love to only have 1,400 diagnoses in a month. Many states are having that many per day. But the evidence from Israel so far is that we should not expect that all of our mitigation efforts are going to be 100% successful in containing this. We are going to have quarantines. And the big number that I want you to look at here on this slide is 28,147. That is by far the biggest number listed here. And it's the number of teachers who were quarantined. And that may include students as well. But I want you to think about quarantine for a moment. When someone is exposed and they have to go into a 14-day quarantine, what do we do? Well, we can't call in a sub. We probably are going to have to go to virtual learning. I'm sure your plans have some kind of procedure in place for that. But I'm sharing this to let you know that it is going to happen. And I hope it doesn't happen in your area, but I'm looking at what's happening in the Sunbelt states, in my own state, and I think this is going to happen. So I think what we've got to do is we've got to be prepared to move to school-wide virtual instruction, or in particular cases, perhaps class-wide virtual instruction. For for the elementary level, we have a certain classroom that maybe nobody is actually sick, but people have been exposed. We may need to go to virtual instruction for a classroom, but it is highly likely, in my view, that many schools are going to have to go to school-wide virtual instruction. If the conditions with the outbreak in their community reach a certain point, I'm not going to be the one to decide what that point is. That is above my pay grade. If we are unable to staff, I think that is probably our primary risk, that we are going to just have staff unavailable. And I think we need to communicate that plan to parents now. We need to say, you know what, we are prepared to do virtual instruction if we need to. And here is the likely scenario where we will need to. It's not just that there is an outbreak, it's that we are unable to staff. And as a result of that vulnerability, I think the way we mitigate that is to communicate a plan for high quality virtual instruction, not just for the people who opt into it. And this is the big flaw that I'm seeing in a lot of plans. There is an option being made available. You know, if you want your kid to engage in virtual learning, sign them up for it and we'll get you some details on that. Okay, fine. What about the plan for when we have to close, when we have no choice because we do not have human beings to staff the classrooms? I think we've got to be proactive about this. We've got to make a data-driven decision, and we've got to be in communication with our public health officials so that we can have those criteria figured out and announced in advance. So lots to consider there. I hope these conversations are ongoing in your area, and I do expect that they will be local decisions. I am not a public health official. I am not an epidemiologist, but what I do know is that staffing is going to be tough, and we've got to be ready for that. Corey, thanks so much for being here. I'm going to share a couple of different recommendations here. I just want to say, especially for our private schools, our parochial schools, you know what? If you have to do virtual instruction, do not lose hope and do not assume that parents will not be okay with that to some extent. They did not choose you for the childcare. I know that is a huge debate right now, and we're not able to do what we would like to do in terms of providing that continuity for families. But just know that if you have people who are paying you tuition, they didn't choose you for the childcare. They didn't choose you for the in-person bricks and mortar only experience. Even if they're saying that right now, there are things that they get from your school that they will continue to get in a temporary virtual environment. And I would be communicating about those even more during this time. A couple of additional communication things. I know we're running a little bit long here. When it comes to staffing-based closures, I think we're going to face the sharpest criticism if we say, well, we're just doing this as a precaution. Well, we're going to close preemptively as a precaution. You know, people are going to hate that. They're already saying, we hate this. We've got to, schools have to reopen. I need to go to work. I need to be able to drop my kid off at school. So I would encourage you to avoid precautionary language and focus on staffing, because staffing is going to be a very real issue. And I think we need to start letting people know that right now. If we have teachers who are not actually sick, but who are just having to self-quarantine, obviously we can have continuity of instruction. Teachers can teach to some extent from home in a modified format. So that's something to keep in mind. In terms of enrollment, I know average daily attendance and tuition and things like that, do matter. What are people looking for? Well, I will tell you, as a parent, I'm looking for continuity of relationships. You know, if my kid has to stay home for a while, I want them to have the same teacher the whole time and not just a proctor who, you know, facilitates their online learning whenever they show up and it's a different person every time. Like, we want that continuity of class relationships, of teacher-student relationships. We want that continuity of curriculum. But above all, I think we want, you know, we want safety. And we want quality, and safety is far and away the first. All right, a couple of final thoughts here. In your plans, one thing that I'm noticing in a few plans is this language around strongly encourage. We will strongly encourage students to wash their hands. We will strongly encourage social distancing. We will strongly encourage students to wear masks. And I have to tell you, people are not buying that. People are seeing through that immediately for the lack of clarity that it is, that it's weak, that if we say masks are strongly encouraged, we know that we will not have masks. If we say social distancing is strongly encouraged, we know that that is not going to be the reality. So if you are getting a lot of pushback from staff, if you're wondering why people are saying, you know what, I'm not sure if I'm going to come back, look for that strongly encouraged language in your plans. And there may need to be some mandates. I think that's just the reality when it comes to safety provisions. All right. One thing I wanted to circle back to around equity. Obviously, the decisions that are being made right now to keep kids home or for teachers to stay home, you know, depend a great deal on privilege and on flexibility and on options and on money. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are saying, I can keep my kid home, so I will. And a lot of other people saying, I don't have a choice. So if school is open, I will send my kid back. We are going to see wildly disproportionate impacts from this whole thing based on socioeconomics above all else. But those impacts are going to be both in terms of learning and in terms of health. So the same kids who are at the greatest risk of falling behind academically, if instruction has to be virtual, I just have to put this out there, that they're also the same kids who are at the greatest health risk if they have to be dropped off at school in person. So it may be that we feel like it's inequitable to say we're closing schools because we know that's going to impact families disproportionately based on their financial situation. But I just want to put this out there, that it is also going to make a bigger difference for their students' health if we have to be the ones to close schools and not try to tolerate unsafe circumstances. All right. Thanks so much, everyone, for being here. In terms of some further thoughts, two things that are available to you. If you're thinking about remote instruction, about making sure that we're able to offer high quality curriculum, especially if you're in a private school that's tuition based, the learning experience really has to be stellar. I want to encourage you to check out Dr. Amy Bader's webinar, free webinar. You can sign your teachers up for it. Designing Meaningful Remote Learning with PBL. Go to amybader.com/remote, and she is offering that again. On designing a unit that will work whether you are in classrooms in person or at home, or whether you have some students in classrooms, some students at home, whether you have one of those wild alternating schedules where people come for a certain number of days and then a different group of people come for a certain number of days. If we design our curriculum with those assumptions in mind, it can be a great experience. So check out that webinar, Designing Meaningful Remote Learning with PBL. And for our roundtable members a little bit more on preparing for virtual first or remote first. Our July roundtable with Jethro Jones focuses all about that. So you should have information on that in your email if you're a member. Jethro Jones is the host of the Transformative Principal podcast and the author of School X, How Principals Can Design a Transformative School Experience. And we are sitting down together to talk in our July roundtable about the ACE method, asynchronous culture essentials for starting the year asynchronously with your staff. If you are not thinking about that right now, I just want to put that on your radar. It may be necessary to start the school year without in-person PD. It may be necessary to have virtual meetings. And if we design that process, if we design those experiences intentionally with that assumption in mind, some better things can happen than if we have to do it in kind of a reactive way. So let me know what you think. I know we are over time here. Let me know in the comments. I will stay on and make some of my additional time available to talk through these if you have additional thoughts here. Let's see. Lindsay is talking about Canada, no active cases in our area. Yeah, Canada has done such a good job in many regions of containing the outbreak. I think the precautions really are proving to pay off, the self-discipline societally that has been put in place. I know people are getting tired of it, but I think those precautions will continue to pay off in Canada. I will expect that, I personally, based on the news stories coming out of Israel, I think there will be outbreaks, but I think they will be containable, and just we need to be prepared for that. And Rivka says the news is from one extreme to the other. Yeah, I mean, this really is a difficult time to assess what's really going on and what's going to happen. And Rivka, I guess I would say the best way to think about this, I'll go back to the black swan idea earlier, is that we really can't think in terms of probabilities. We really cannot think in terms of how likely is this scenario to happen, because we don't know. We just don't know what's going to happen. But what we can do is we can make ourselves less vulnerable. And what I would encourage you to do is prepare for virtual. I think we're going to rely on it much more than we think we are going to. So let's just do the very best job that we can with that. Let's open in person if the circumstances allow, if staffing allows. But I really wanted to put on your radar today the possibility of staffing not being there and having to close because of that. So bring that up with your senior leadership team. Reach out to me at any time if I can be of assistance. And thanks so much for being here. I appreciate your time. Please take care of yourself. Please get some rest, do some fun things. We went down to the beach yesterday and just kind of walked along the beach and did nothing. And we just kind of needed that. And I know you probably need that even more than my family does with all the decisions that you're making. So please take care of yourself, walk your dog, pet your cat, take a nap, all those things that you need to do to take care of yourself and tell the people closest to you to do the same. Thank you for being here. I struggled with whether to even bring up these topics, but I think we'll be in better shape if we think through them. But having said that, take care of yourself and have a wonderful day. Appreciate you.